You are listening to All Access Pass, created by the Accessibility Collective on 101.9 CITR FM.
Hello and welcome back to All Access Pass. Happy Wednesday, and I am today's host, Kaylin, and I am joined in studio by Sarah, Deepy, and Desi. So for today's show, we will be having a live interview with Shannon Ray from the CBC documentary Love, Hope, and Autism, which premieres this Sunday. After this, we will be talking about the seating symposium that occurred last week here in Vancouver. But first, we'll be heading into a song break. So here is Book Club by the Arkells. Make sure to stick around for our interview with Shannon Ray.
Translation? Discorder Magazine's March issue is coming in like a lion, but it's not going out like a lamb. The issue is hitting the streets at its over 100 distribution spots made possible by our fearless advertisers, The Rickshaw, Mint Records, Timber Concerts, Blueprint Events, The Rio Theater, The Cinematheque Theater, Massey Books, and the Alma Mater Society. If you prowl around Van, you'll be able to read up on Man Up Vancouver, its wild success and 10-year anniversary celebration, an interview with Shindig's majestic winner Mama Rudgal, how the Poetry is Bad for You reading series captures your soul, a poem submission by cherished Cree Métis writer Samantha Nock, and, of course, a full harvest of album, podcast, and book reviews and live show reviews of local bands. Translation, forever local, forever free, always salty.
Don't wait for a day. You learn something new every day, new every day, till the day that you die. I left school years ago, thought you should know.
And although there's obstacles, struggles and falls, there's a brick wall. I'm not saying you're mean, but there are some things.
Welcome back. You just heard Book Club by the Arkells and New Survival by Elevator. So now we are going to be having an interview with Shannon Ray from the upcoming documentary Love, Hope, and Autism, which we were lucky enough to get an exclusive look at. So here is Sarah to tell us more.
Hi. So we're talking to Shannon, who is... Hi. We're talking this Sunday on March 18th. The CBC documentary Love, Hope, and Autism is debuting on CBC TV. And Love, Hope, and Autism follows home movie footage, taking the viewer on the Fresco family's deeply personal journey of raising a son with autism spectrum disorder. This film gives an intimate look inside a family as they deal with autism from birth through adulthood, as well as a heartbreaking outcome for many autistic children aging out of a publicly funded system. Joining us over the phone today is Mother Shannon Ray herself from the Fresco family. Hi, Shannon.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Hi. I thought your documentary was really sincere and insightful, but for the audience, could you tell us a little bit about the documentary Love, Hope, and Autism?
Yes, Love, Hope, and Autism, which is airing on Sunday, the 18th on CBC, covers a span of 21 years in the life of my twins, Hallie and Fraser Fresco. My son Fraser was diagnosed with autism at the age of 3. And the reason that we were, you know, amazingly enabled in being able to do this film is that my former spouse, Robert Fresco, is a cinematographer, and he really followed the children around with his camera pretty much from birth all the way until their 21st birthday and continues to do so. So we really get to watch as this boy, who is apparently quote-unquote normal, becomes autistic, becomes very apparently autistic on screen, and grows into manhood. So it's a very long, it's a lifelong look, really, at our family and some of the challenges that we've had, the joys, the craziness, the journey that we have undertaken with Fraser and his sister Hallie.
Yeah, and I mean, part of what makes this documentary so unique and incredible is the fact that they have been filmed their entire lives. What was it like for you to be filmed so consistently? And for the rest of the family, I know Hallie mentioned being quite uncomfortable with that at times.
Yes, Hallie actually really, when she was little, my daughter Hallie, kind of thought that the camera was her dad's face. because she rarely saw him without the camera between her and him. And, you know, it became very usual for us because it was just always going on and we didn't really even notice too much. But it was very different once we had a film crew coming and spending time with us in our home and following us around and, you know, doing things with us. So that was an unusual experience.
Yeah, that would probably
be. And it was a little unnerving. But we finally got used to them and became great friends with them, too, as the 2 years of production of the film kind of unfolded.
Yeah, I mean, that would be really pointed to have someone there all the time that isn't even part of the family there. I also... was really, I noticed how honest you were about your feelings of, you know, the fear of the unknown, and you said Fraser is growing into a man now, and I wonder how you manage expectations for Fraser, and, you know, feelings of doubt as you don't know what his life is going to look like.
Well, that really began for me when he was diagnosed, because I had kind of a daydream map in my mind of who he was and what his life was going to be like, and it suddenly was just in a moment gone, and I really didn't know what it was going to look like. And I think that that dropping of expectations when he was three has served me pretty well, because it's enabled me to see Fraser with autism as part of his personhood rather than something that we have to overcome.
That's a really cool thing.
The interesting thing is now when public school finishes and there's no real clear picture, you know, we don't have another map that says he finishes school on this day and then the next thing is he does this, because there are the bubble of people with autism in North America, which is over 300,000 people in Canada and over 3 million people in the United States, is large and overwhelming. Services are underfunded, programs are overwhelmed. And so there's no guarantee that we have a path for Fraser that's set out for us by government or social services or anything else. And I think it's something that we have to become really creative about for him and continue to not have expectations, but be open to possibility.
That's a really, really awesome outlook. But I know what you're saying about the resources, and I'm actually wondering if you decided to live where you live because of the resources available to Fraser.
Well, what was really funny was that Hallie and Fraser were born in Ontario, and at the time of Fraser's diagnosis, you know, the social worker that came to see us said that, you know, in the couple of years prior, he had had maybe two cases of autism in his area, and he suddenly had 35, and they couldn't cope. And so Fraser was on waiting lists the whole time we lived in Ontario. Then we moved to BC, and he was again on waiting lists. So he was 12 when we moved to the United States and had never had any kind of intervention services at all because he had remained on waiting lists. We moved to Arizona and he had, within days, he had every kind of therapy you could possibly imagine. And he thrived in that environment. Then when we moved to California, not as much, because we have a large population in this state. The regional center that oversees services and programs for people with developmental disabilities in our area, for instance, has 34,000 cases that they're managing. And so we're going to be moving again to try to find that El Dorado of a place where Fraser will have something productive to do.
I don't even know what to say to that. I've never really thought much about it. That's really interesting. Thank you. So I actually had a couple more questions from what I saw in the documentary. I was wondering, because Hallie talks a lot about how she feels resentment towards her father for not giving her as much attention. And I was wondering if it ever plays against Fraser as well, or if it just really is kept towards the parents, or...
I'm having a little bit of difficulty hearing you. I apologize.
Oh, it's because of...
Could you repeat?
Yeah, it's the way it's set up. I know Hallie talks about feelings of resentment towards her father for not giving her as much attention. And I'm wondering if... Well, first I was wondering how you guys have... Like, do you make very intentional time together to prevent that? And I was also kind of wondering, like, does that resentment ever fall on Fraser?
It's very interesting. I think that the neurotypical siblings of children who have developmental disabilities, or really any kind of, who are differently abled in any sort of way, get a bit of short shrift, you know, because so much time and attention and so much oxygen in the family is consumed by the one child that the other one gets a little bit left behind. And Robert was very much, had sort of taken Fraser as his child, quote unquote. And So Hallie was very much left out of that equation because Fraser and Robert were very close. Hallie and I were very, very close. But of course, my time and attention is also taken up with Fraser. And I did very intentionally, I would make sort of specific dates with Hallie. And one of the fun things when we did live in Vancouver is that we would say we're going to do our travel the world days. And we would find, we would go to Chinatown or something, or to the Japanese gardens, and we would learn about other cultures, and we would spend time doing these kind of little trips around the world together. And she loved that, and it was really great. And I think it's really important to kind of make those sort of dates with your typically abled child in order to make it really, really special, so that it has much more of a heft than the average ordinary time that you spend with them. I think that helped to some degree, but she really does struggle with having felt not only left out, but also as a twin, having a sense of having to care for her brother. And that has never really tipped over into resentment, but there was a period when they were teenagers where she really had to individuate from him in order to find her own focus and her own sense of her own life.
Yeah, it seems like from the documentary they're getting back together quite well, though.
Yes, they are.
Cool.
They finally come to adulthood and they're good buddies.
Neat. Well, I guess the answer is always date night then.
Yep.
So what was it like bringing your husband Tim into the picture? How did that factor into things?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear all of the question.
What was it like bringing your husband Tim into the picture? How did that change things?
Oh, Tim, first of all, Tim is a saint. I'll just say that up front. He would disagree with me on that. But we really worked to very slowly integrate him into the Hallie and Fraser's lives, to make it easier for Robert to also accommodate having another man as part of their lives too. I have to say I'm very fortunate because Tim and Robert really kind of immediately liked one another. And at the point when we moved to Arizona and far away from where Robert was in Hope, BC, Tim promised Robert that he would love Hallie and Fraser as his own children. And he did that with his arms around Robert, you know, in a very strong sort of way when Robert was feeling very sad. And that has enabled us to navigate as three parents together, and to for each Robert and Tim to have their own roles with the kids that are complementary, I guess I would say. Tim is the papa bear, the big protector, and you know, his overriding mission really is to keep Fraser safe and comfortable, and the same with Hallie, and Hallie knows that too, which has given her a great sense of comfort.
Yeah, it must have been, yeah, interesting at the start for sure, just integrating everyone and making them feel welcome and warm.
We've had a couple of meetings at school when Robert's been here with us, and you know, me sitting between Tim and Robert, and the teacher's just looking at us and shaking their head.
Yeah.
Saying, how do you guys do this? You know?
Modern family.
Mm-hmm.
One last question. Can you offer some insight for what this film hopes to accomplish?
The film, because it does show really a lifetime or a big chunk of a lifetime with our family and with our children, shows how different the journey is at various points in life with somebody who has a developmental disability. And I think one of the points that it actually makes that's really wonderful is that we're continually surprised, and new ability comes forward as life goes forward. And I think that's a really important message that comes across. But I think that in our desire to make this film, or submit to the making of this film, really, was to show that, you know, so many families become fractured by the challenges and the unrelenting pressures of these kinds of situations. And that even if your family doesn't look the same that you had hoped it would, it can still be a family nonetheless. And there can still be love and acceptance as the raison d'etre, you know, for your life. And if that's imparted, and if people see that and find that understanding in themselves about what's possible, I think our mission will have been accomplished. But we won't know until people see it on Sunday.
Yeah, that's true. Do you connect to very many other families at all?
Have we met very many other families?
With children with autism?
Oh, yes. Over the years, you know, it was interesting because I was actually 37 when I found that I was going to have Hallie and Fraser. And many of my friends were not raising families at the time. And so some of those friendships diverged. But new people came into our lives by virtue of our children. And I was so lucky to have this secret society of autism mothers to spend time with, who, you know, were very encouraging and inspiring. And all of our children are incredibly different, because people on the autism spectrum are quite unique. You can't say that any two people with autism are really alike. So it makes it difficult to share ideas and say, do this, do that. But what we share is our stories of the funny, you know, crazy things that our children do, and laugh together and share the journey, which has been quite amazing.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Shannon, and we're really excited to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, great. Thanks.
All right, so make sure you all check out this documentary, Love, Hope, and Autism, which debuts Sunday, March 18th at 9 p.m. on CBC. Thank you so much again, Shannon. Now we will be going into a song break. So here is This Isn't Disneyland by our featured disabled artist of the week by the Sisters of Intervention, who is Australia's first ever all-girl pop group with disability.
I left school years ago, thought you should know. And although there's obstacles, struggles and falls, there's a brick wall. Oh,
Understand more about fashion. We asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism as opposed to someone who buys, like, you know, let's say, you know, someone buys a
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.
Welcome back to All Access Pass. That was This Isn't Disneyland by the Sisters of Intervention. Next up, we will have DP, who is going to introduce our coverage over the seating symposium that happened last week. So with that, DP, take it away.
Hi. So last week, Desi and I had the chance to attend the 34th Annual Seating Symposium Conference. This event brought together wheelchair technicians, researchers, manufacturers, and others who work to improve seating and mobility among people with disabilities in Canada and around the world.
So I'm a technician at Advanced Mobility.
How does Canada compare to other countries when it comes to advanced technology in power wheelchairs?
So back to your question, the technology wheelchair, we're not bad here, you know, in Canada. We're still missing some stuff from Europe, but it does come down. And, you know, if they launch something in Europe, we see it here probably within a year or two in Canada, which is, it's not horrible, but it's good.
What are some kind of cool features that power wheelchairs have nowadays?
You know, the most advanced cool feature I see it, now when they come to power seating, they use like a smart actuator, which is smart motor to move the tilt. Tilt back, forward, up, down, move the legs and all this. So this is actually really, really very handy. I mean, like for a client or for even us to know where's that position for the chair. There's new technology coming with a few chairs, whereas for us as a technician, we can have access to the chair to fix the chair. We don't need to, you know, drive the car 2 hours to see the client, and sometimes we cannot fix it because we need just to assess it. But we can access from here, open the computer or your phone, and have access to the chair, see what's the problem, and then when you go there, you should have your parts ready to fix it. So this is what they use, like a GSM network. It's the same thing. It does give a feedback. We're talking about this smart actuator for the seating. It does give a feedback to the OT if the client tells, you know, a certain degree of every day, or the doctor too, because in his condition, he has to tilt, let's say, 20 degrees every day, at, you know, maybe four times or five times, or depends what they agree to. So this is the technology which is, I see it as very handy down the road, so for everyone to when they have access to it.
In your opinion, what is the coolest part about your job?
You know, it's actually, all my clients are like my family, which is, I deal with every client is actually part of me, because you're not only fixing a chair or set up the chairs. That relation, it goes beyond that. You start chatting about your, you know, outside work and family and this and that. So at the end of that, your client is actually, you know, part of your family.
Okay, I'm Maureen Story, and I'm a physical and occupational therapist, and I work at Sunny Hill Health Center for Children, and I'm the chair of the International Seating Symposium. And this is our 34th International Seating Symposium, so we've been around for a while.
And how does it feel to have an event you've been planning and seeing it come together today?
Oh, it's fantastic. I think this is our largest symposium as far as delegates go that we've ever had. So it's really great to see so many people so enthused about such a focused practice. The International Seating Symposium actually started back in 1983, and it was started by Sunny Hill Health Center for Children because we were just starting our position mobility team, and we wanted to educate ourselves. So we decided the best way to do that would be bring the experts from around the world to us. So we had our very first symposium in 1983. And then we had two more symposiums after that, and each time more and more people wanted to come to it. And then we partnered with the University of Memphis in Tennessee because they were doing a similar sort of conference and they wanted to become partners with us. So from then on, we kind of have split it. So on the even years, it's in Vancouver, and in the odd years, it's in the United States. So we've gone back and forth, but it's always been very, very focused on seating and mobility, and we've really tried hard to make it very clinical and research-oriented and stay away from more the sales pitch about equipment, and that's why we have an exhibit hall.
Right.
So in the exhibit hall, you can come in and we can meet all the manufacturers and they can show, you know, their latest innovations, and we can have a great talk with them there. In the actual program itself, we do have a lot of manufacturers and equipment dealers that present as well too, but they present more on the principles and, you know, research and best practice, not specifically on one piece of equipment and how great it is.
Right.
So, and it's been really great. We have over 102 exhibitors here today. And we have 70 exhibitors on our wait list. So when you go through the exhibit hall, you're going to see lots of different equipment from, like you said, very, very small for a very small child to, you know, adult size equipment as well, too. And we're learning more and more through research that we need to get very young children mobile, so they're independently mobile. So you're going to see wheelchairs that are smaller and smaller because we're putting kids in very early. Those kids that we know will probably never walk on their own.
Right.
We want to get them into something, either manual or power mobility, so that they can increase their function and increase their participation in life. You know, and that's the main aim, is to be able to get anybody to do what they want to do. You know, it's not about, you know, working your muscle and seeing how strong you can get your biceps. It's, can I get out of my house, down to the playground to play with my friends? Can I get to the store to buy what I want to buy? And can I, you know, go bowling or go to a party? You know, it's life. We want individuals to live their life to their fullest. And so that's what all this equipment is about, is allowing them to then be independent to do whatever they choose to do in their life.
My name is Alan Boyd, and I'm the General Manager for Permobile Canada. And so Permobile is a company that specializes in many things, but in particular mobility. Powered mobility, and that's how I got to meet.
What makes Jody and DP's chair stand out from, the, for example, the other models that you have?
Well, they're very involved, what we call custom seating. And so that there's fixed seating, so that we had a custom molded seating made. They also have some positional requirements, for example, lateral tilt and rotational tilt to help with pressure relief. So they're making sure they're managing where they're positioned in the chair and also for transfers. So it's very unique. We're the only company that does this.
Right.
This kind of custom work.
Yeah. DP was saying, because in the past, because last year we had that torrential snow and she wasn't able to get through the snow, and now with her new chair, it's a lot easier.
Okay, that's good to hear. You never say never. Yeah. They do well in the snow, but it's like anything else.
For sure. So how long has your company been around? Is it a Canadian company?
Good question. No, it's a Swedish company, and we just had our 50th anniversary. And so we have a global footprint. We're in, I believe, over 17 countries, 1,700 employees worldwide. And so we specialize in power mobility, manual mobility. We make titanium manual wheelchairs that are actually like orthotic wheels, in that we start with a tube. We also specialize in seating and positioning. And so as you see, the custom seating as well as just cushions and backs, all specializing in mobility.
Right. So what I'm looking at right now is like a mini wheelchair.
Yes.
Very cute. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? So this is for children, or?
It is for children, and actually it's the only chair in the world like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's our launch. It's brand new. It's called the Pilot. So it allows young individuals who are active, who can self-propel, a very stable platform that can grow with them.
Right.
Probably up to, depending on the child, to 12 years of age. But we could see someone in there is at 18 months to 2 years old, if they are dependent on mobility.
Awesome. There's the DP has that has like, and I know she was saying that she has like very special software in her wheelchair.
Yeah.
And is that the stability kind
of
aspect of it?
It's a good question. The stability is a platform, but we also have the software or program that goes with the power seat function. So what I mean by power seat functions, there's actuators that will actually move her seating. It can raise her up, it can lower, it can rotate her, and we have to make sure that regardless of the position she's in, it's not going to become less stable or hurt her.
Right.
For example, that leg rest can't hit the front caster.
Right.
So we actually set very strict parameters in terms of the movement of the seating system. Well, it's a great question. The chair itself was made in Tennessee, the power platform. It got shipped to Sweden, where we have some very specialized custom technicians that made your seating, the actual mechanical part. Then it came back to Vancouver, and then someone else did your custom seating, that the actual interface between you and the chair. And then, you know, Wabi, and in particular, from Advanced Mobility, and Drew from Permobil, they had to do all the programming to make sure the chair was safe and was giving you the functional movement that you needed.
Yeah.
And so it's quite an iterative process.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's been 2 years.
It's been 2 years.
Yes.
Nationwide. How many people worked on these chairs?
On the actual platform itself, I'm going to say there's probably 3 or 4 people. One person in particular that would kind of assemble it from beginning. That was done in Tennessee. And then obviously we got a lot of people involved in logistics in terms of shipping, receiving, getting the chair to go to Sweden. And there, I think there was 2 people in particular that worked on it. And then when it came back, there was a team here in Vancouver, including your therapist, Michael, Drew, Wabi. And so what's that at the end of the day? Probably almost 15 to 20 people.
Quite the
probably
team.
Involved.
3 countries.
And 3 countries.
International effort.
Can you tell us who you are and what your role is?
Well, my name is Lorenzo Romero, and my role at Stealth is I'm president of the company. I'm one of the original founders of the company. We started the company back in 1999.
So what does your company specifically deal with when it comes to wheelchairs?
We're primarily in the seating and positioning side of the business, with a lot of the accessories that go on for secondary pieces, head supports, lateral supports, seating systems, a lot of the positioning components that go in after the chair is built.
Oh, okay. And
What? So actually behind you is a variety of, are these joysticks?
Yes.
And what is kind of like unique about the products that you offer? What are some of the cool things that they do?
Well, for example, our electronic component of the company now is, you know, we do alternative controls. So yes, joysticks, switches, and just specialty controls like that. So, for example, our iDrive, which is our head control system, so you can drive with, you know, using your head. We just developed a game called the Loons, which I think is one of the most revolutionary products to come out in a long time.
Yeah.
And what it does, it allows you to play this game while you're playing the game. It's collecting data. So you can identify whether there's that individual is capable of cognitively understanding what right is, what left is, what forward and reverse is.
Oh, wow.
So now you're able to earlier on identify a potential power chair user. So I think that's one of the unique things about our electronics. We're talking about 1, 2 years old. I mean, kids are starting to walk,
right,
crawl, move at a very young age, right?
Right.
And so same thing with the disability community. You know, there's the same need for them to be able to move and interact with their environment.
So before you actually give it to the client to try it yourself first?
Yeah, a lot of times we'll do the best that we can,
yeah,
internally to do our testing.
Yeah.
But ultimately, we bring in the resources, the end user, to really give us that feedback. Hey, is this what we ultimately needed,
yeah,
for the industry? Is this what makes sense? Sometimes we hit it right on the mark, and other times we're like, what are we thinking, you know?
Right, yeah.
So but we definitely rely a lot on the end user for that feedback.
Right. And a lot of your students, like, how do you bridge that kind of, like, understanding someone with a disability and what kind of their needs are?
Yeah, for me, I mean, I feel very fortunate and blessed to be in the industry. But when I first started, I had no idea, right?
Yeah.
And so what I've always done is I always like to just communicate. You know, what is it that you're looking for?
Right.
And try to understand clearly what the goal is to try to achieve, you know, movement or positioning. And that's been my, I guess you could say, key to success, right?
Okay.
Is just understanding what the need is. And then going back and not assuming that what I've come up with is what was asked, and just to try it and make sure it does accomplish what we were looking to do.
And how do you keep up with the technology? I mean, it's always changing year by year, so how do you keep up with it?
That's a great question. You know, I like to think that we actually are the ones pushing the technology.
Okay.
You know, because I feel like in our industry,
yeah,
we're a little bit behind in the times.
Yeah.
When you look at electronics and some of the things that are out there and technology that are out there, we haven't brought all that into this industry like we should. Our cars can do amazing things today,
yeah,
you know, and so why aren't we bringing those technologies into our chairs, into these products? And that's kind of why we came up with the game, things like that, to try to push the technology that is already in the mainstream into our industry here. So to your point is, we're trying to always stay kind of current with those and trying to bring those into our industry as quickly as we can.
Do you have any more questions?
No, I'm good.
I'm really interested in this video game. What has been the reception from kids playing this game?
Fantastic. You know, people are like, why didn't we think of that before?
Uh-huh.
You know, because it's like so intuitive. When I have a great story, if you don't, you know, my story.
Yeah, no.
When I first started, I had a chance to go to a seminar that was being held. And the next day they were going to bring a 16-year-old boy who'd been begging to be in a power chair, but a doctor and this therapist wouldn't approve the power chair.
Why was that?
They didn't think he was cognitive enough to be able to do it. He had cerebral palsy, so you know they didn't think he had the motor skills to be able to do it. Well, his mom found out about the seminar, so you know, being a mom, you know, she's like, I need to take my son there, and so she asked if she could bring him. They positioned him, they set him up with this head array, and he literally drove out between all the tables, straight through, out the door, and there was not a dry eye in that room, including myself. That was 20 years ago. And I thought to myself, what a shame that it took that long for him to get in a power chair, because people didn't believe in him enough. And so this game, it doesn't take that much effort to put it on a chair. You don't have to be in a power chair. You could be in a mangle chair. Put the headrest on, the head array, plug the game in, connect with the Bluetooth, and just let him play. they don't even have to know they're being evaluated. They just they play the game, and behind the scenes, it's gathering all the statistical information so you can see how accurate they were going right, how accurate they were going left, and you can see if they've got the cognitive ability to do it. And you can also see how they're improving. It's got different levels, so as you're getting better, you move to the next level. And ultimately, it gives you the ability to say, look, I know he or she can drive. Let's get him in the power chair. And for me, that's a big thing. Independence, I think it's a great thing.
Awesome.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm just curious, so if you have somebody who you know who could benefit from using that video game to find out what their needs are, how would they go about accessing you to get that?
We just released a game, so like in the States, we're getting them out to all the facilities. Mm-hmm. So therapists can have access to them. Mm-hmm. They can just, we're setting them up with screens and whatnot, mm-hmm. so they can go in and try them. So that's how we're doing in the U.S., and that's how we're going to try doing in Canada as well.
So our company, we're called the ETAC Group. And the ETAC Group consists of six different companies. Two of them are pediatric. R82, the number R82, and Convade are kids' products. And then we have four other ones that are adult-focused. Mm-hmm. The kids' products do anything from wheelchairs and custom strollers, gait training, standing aids, car seats, hygiene products. We also do a line of transfer systems and right. overhead lifts.
Right. Okay.
This product here actually collapses and folds.
Oh, okay.
Goes in that box. You can actually take it with you traveling for free. It's TSA approved.
Oh, nice. Very
awesome.
Important. So what would someone be able to do in the lift?
Well, it depends on the lift. We have overhead lifts, or we do home access. So if someone wanted to stay in their home and needed a lot of lift systems, you can actually put permanent rails in. So that's one option. A system like this is basically helping the transfer. It could be from, you know, a morning transfer into a chair.
What's part of your job?
You know, I told you that I got involved with this because of sports. And in sports and recreation, to see a child or a young kid or adult water ski or snow ski or kayak is really kind of an emotional tie for me. Even if I've done this 30 years, if I'm teaching someone new, it's the same feeling. I get the same feeling out of our products that we sell. Putting a child in a gait trainer and seeing right. them take the first steps
right.
is really kind of it's really exciting. So there's a lot of passion for people that work for our company because they, you know, they see it, they experience it with the families. So that's probably, you know, just that excitement.
I was going to say, you probably deal with the most entertaining and energetic demographic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of, a lot of the equipment, you know, it has a purpose, you know, a physiotherapy purpose.
Yeah.
But when you're working with children, it's about having fun, too.
Yeah.
You know, and if fun can be part of therapy, then it's everyone wins.
Yeah, especially when you're interacting with someone.
Awesome. Well, we hope you enjoyed our coverage of the 34th Annual Seating Symposium, and we're going to head into a break.
You that Vancouver has a housing problem?
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
For real, man. For real, man. Should have seen it. Should have seen it. Should have seen it. Y'all. You know, the seven virgins, and God, that tree, yo, I stole peaches right off that tree. Those peaches, that tree takes 6,000 years to blossom. Reminiscing with dirty needles at the end of a road trip about the celestial peaches and how back in the day I stole shit. I was undisciplined and arrogant, but I'ma control it. Just then we got to the venue, I was like, wait, hold it. Where is everybody? The streets and the club was empty. Not even a dude at the door collecting the entry fee. It's Touch, the divine monkey, you don't remember me? There's the promoter, yo, dude, people gonna show eventually? He started looking toward the back where the exit be. I was about to deck a G. Dirty Needles is like respectively. Me and Touch is trying to find out what happened. He said, I'll pay you for the show. I promise you.
Oh, music is my life.
Are you interested in Vancouver's local music scene? Then join CITR's Music Collective. We handle all things music, from setting, taken down, and just enjoying live performances to archiving. Join the collective to hang out with like-minded, music-obsessed folks. Open to everyone, no experience necessary. For Word on the Street podcasts and more info about the collective, visit CITR.ca and email volunteer@CITR.ca to get involved.
All right, and that has been our show for today. Thank you for tuning in. If you're interested in joining our team or think there's an issue we should bring up on our show, please send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca. Thank you to Shannon Ray from the upcoming documentary Love, Hope, and Autism. Love, Hope, and Autism debuts Sunday, March 18th at 9 p.m. on CBC TV Eastern Time.
Thank you to everyone at the 34th Annual Seating Symposium who spoke to us, and Wabi Geber. Remember to like us on All Access Pass Facebook page. And if you're on Twitter and Instagram, please follow us at @access_CITR.
And as always, if you missed on any of our live shows or want to listen again, you can listen to our podcast show on CITR.ca by going on the search box and searching All Access Pass. Thank you for listening and tune into our show next week, Wednesday at 4 p.m. Stick around for Arts Report, which is up next. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Take care. Woo!